This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Life sustains itself by cell division. So does cancer. Breast cancer cells multiply faster because of CDK4/6 proteins. But what if we could block those proteins and stop runaway cell division? To that end, Dana-Farber scientists laid the foundation for CDK4/6 inhibitors, new drugs that are increasing the survival rate for many advanced breast cancers. Dana-Farber's momentum of discovery keeps finding new ways to outmaneuver cancer. Learn more at danafarber.org/everywhere.
On the program today, some words about this economy. Which words, though, is the catch? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Ruzdahl. It is Tuesday today, the 25th of July. Good as always to have you along, everybody. Seven words, to be precise, with which to begin the program. S&P, CoreLogic, Case, Shiller, Home, Price, Index. It's a mouthful, I know, but it is kind of the benchmark for home prices in this economy. And we tell you about it often, as we do, because what happens with housing can give us a sense of what's going to happen with this economy. So, to cut to the chase, home prices in May were up and down. This is not, however, Schrodinger's housing market, and quantum mechanics will not be required to make sense of it, or at least that's what Marketplace's Sabri Benishore promised me.
Home prices in May were down if you compare them to the year before. Same story with April.
What's happened is that the market peaked in roughly June of 2022, so that's why we're lower today than we were a year ago.
Craig Lazara is a managing director at S&P Dow Jones Indices. Some places had wild drops in existing home prices. The Western U.S. had it the worst. Seattle and San Francisco were both down around 11%. Jenny Schutz is a senior fellow at Brookings.
Seattle and San Francisco are two of the markets that have been hardest hit by the increasing rate of work from home.
Both are cities, Schutz says, with a lot of remote tech jobs and people who asked, why pay Seattle and San Francisco housing prices if I don't have to? Meanwhile, the Midwest saw existing home prices rise. Cleveland up almost 4%. Chicago up almost 5%.
It's a result of the fact that they didn't boom as much in 2021 and 2020.
Chris Mayer is a professor of real estate at Columbia Business School.
And therefore, they didn't fall as much in 22. So they've been kind of more steady.
But one thing all the major cities in the Case-Shiller Index had in common was that existing home prices started rising again in February of this year, even though the Fed has been raising interest rates.
It's really the imbalance of supply and demand.
So at least for now, we are back to the same old housing script we've had for decades. We don't have enough homes. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishore for Marketplace.
On Wall Street on this Tuesday, one word, five letters, it's a verb, R-A-L-L-Y. We will have the rally details when we do the numbers. Every year, hundreds of millions of tons of freight move up and down the Mississippi River, most of it on barges, usually stable and safe and reliable. But just as we are dealing with the increasing day-to-day realities of climate change, see also the temperature, so too are our rivers. Austin Golding is the CEO of the family business Golding Barge Lines in Vicksburg, Mississippi. Austin, good to talk to you. How are you?
Hey, Kai, doing great. How are you doing today?
I'm all right. Let's just climb into this thing since you and I have done this a zillion times. First of all, as always, how's business at Golding Barge Lines?
Our business is going great. We've actually seen an uptick in demand for our services and volumes this year. And we've seen a pretty good balance of equipment versus volume on the liquid side. And on the aggregate and raw material side, it seems to be pretty steady also. There's a lot of economic activity in our area of the world. And both of those materials and the movement of those materials seems to be in demand right now.
Not to put you on the hook, but play a little Jay Powell for me. Do you see an economic slowdown in the next, like, 6 to 12 months?
Well, Kai, I think you're asking the right guy when you're asking a towboater from Vicksburg, Mississippi. So let me give you the hard, cold, short and sweet on it. But, no, I think that there probably is some more pullback to be had. I mean, I can tell even in the pricing of our equipment, the pricing for new equipment and the pricing for repair on that equipment has to come down. Even though our business is good, we're not seeing any growth. And if, at some point, the pricing will get good enough that it'll encourage some of that growth. But for right now, even though we're profitable, it is still too expensive to grow.
So what are you going to do about it? If it's too expensive to grow, and if you're not growing, you're standing still, I mean, you're running a business, man. What are you going to do?
Well, I really think, you know, in the short term, we're still focused on our human issues. We're so cyclical, Kai.
Wow.
Our workforce will not stick with us through those down cycles. And we don't treat them the best, really. We stagnate wages. We lay people off. We start back with less experienced people from the beginning. So we need a little equilibrium. We need a couple of years to try to get our feet underneath us and grow our talent.
You know, it's funny. You and I have been talking for I don't even know how many years now. And I think every time labor force comes up from you.
Yes, absolutely. I have a number of ideas as to why we're here. And I think that the quick answer that we've had as an industry is to just increase wages. I mean, our wages are as high as they've ever been. But the work-life balance that we all seem to talk about, regardless of what industry, when I ask you to come live at work and work floats around the country, that's a big ask.
Yeah.
So we've really been focused on life on the boat and how we can best attach work-life balance to living at work.
Let's talk about a couple of nuts and bolts things. Last time we had John, which was October last year, you were dealing with low water levels, and then we had flooding and high water because of the snowmelt in the spring. Where are you now, and how worried are you about environmental issues generally, and then also, you know, climate change? Because you're out there in it every day.
No doubt. And Kai, I love your listeners are very educated. And so whenever they ask me, they say, you haven't been on Marketplace in a while. What's been going on? I said, well, the river's probably pretty consistent right now. You know, we usually only talk around high and low water events and how that affects the economy. But
that's funny.
We are headed towards a low water season here. It looks like it's not going to be as bad as last year, which would be great.
Yeah.
But yes, overall, the effect of the climate on our business is very direct. The amount of water we have to operate on is directly translates to our bottom line. And we definitely feel like the weather patterns are getting more extreme. And we've also seen as population centers have grown around our watershed, the water gets into the system a lot faster, or the water can be retained from our system if that water is needed in these civilian areas along our waterways. All that being said, I think the Corps of Engineers has never been better at operating our inland water system as they are right now.
When was the last time you got to get out of the office and actually do a little work?
Well, I got on one of our boats just the other day down in Texas. I always walk away renewed and really kind of motivated to become somebody that's more of an embodiment of where the action is rather than somebody that just gets to hear about it. But duty calls, and it's very, very tough to find those hours to get out there, but they have to be a priority, especially when you're relying on equipment and talent as a business like we are.
It's always good to get out of the office. Austin Golding runs a family business down in Vicksburg, Mississippi. It's called Golding Barge Lines. Austin, thanks a lot. Good to talk to you.
Thank you, Kai. Take care.
Federal Reserve started its two-day interest rate setting meeting today, press conference tomorrow, which is why we were talking yesterday about something Jay Powell and a whole bunch of other Fed officials have been saying a whole lot lately.
Monetary policy affects economic activity with long and variable lags.
The famous long and variable lags.
Long and variable lags.
Long and variable lags.
Long and variable lags.
And we gave you yesterday the long and variable lag origin story.
Generally, the term is associated with Milton Friedman.
What Milton Friedman is meaning with this long and variable lags is that the effects of central bankers take a rather long time to have their full effects seen in the economy.
The long and variable lag is one of these nostrums that's passed into conventional wisdom, but was not conventional wisdom when Friedman started talking about it.
That's Peter Ireland, professor of economics at Boston College. Vasco Carvalho, he's at the University of Cambridge. And Jennifer Burns, she's the author of a new biography about Milton Friedman. So today, Milton Friedman's long and variable lag, circa 2023. But first, a little history. In 1961, Friedman wrote a journal article called The Lag in Effect of Monetary Policy. We will spare you the details, but the TLDR is that Friedman said it can take a long time for monetary policy action like raising or lowering interest rates to work its way through the economy.
Now, it turns out that about 10 years later, Friedman wrote another paper and found that, in fact, it can be up to 2 years before the full effects are found on inflation.
2 years. And you got to remember that back then,
there actually used to be a long and variable lag between the Fed doing something and people knowing what it had actually done.
There was no announcement when the Fed changed interest rates. There was no press conferences.
These were secret meetings, and you might find out 6 months later what happened.
Surprise. So that's one difference from today. Here's another one.
You should really think that Friedman is like being a hero in a very data-poor environment.
Economists today have way more data, way more tools than Milton Friedman had.
Over the last decade, particularly during COVID, you may have seen this explosion of indicators, right? What happened last week in St. Louis? What was the card expenditures in downtown Manhattan on a given weekend, et cetera?
We've talked about this. Economists today can look at credit card transactions, hotel occupancy rates, other high-frequency indicators, they're called, to track the economy almost in real time.
Some people find longer lags, some people find shorter lags. And I think it's fair to say that the evidence is mixed.
And while economists do understand much better than, say, what Milton Friedman was writing, these transmission mechanisms of how exactly monetary policy eventually, goes into every crack in the economy is not still well understood.
And that gets us back to Jay Powell and the Federal Open Market Committee trying to decide whether to keep raising interest rates, by how much, and for how long.
I think what the concept of the long and variable lag does is tries to orient policymakers to a clear and consistent path rather than one that's too responsive to quarterly information about how the economy is doing.
The other thing it does, even 60 years on, is gives the Fed some cover to say, we just don't know yet.
There was an old literature that made those lags out to be fairly long.
That's Powell in a press conference last November when year-over-year inflation was running at 8.2%, and he had just raised interest rates for the sixth time in a row, and then he went on.
There's newer literature that says that they're shorter. And, the truth is we don't have a lot of data of inflation of this high in what is now the modern economy.
And here he is just last month when the Fed skipped a rate hike.
It's sort of standard thinking that monetary policy affects economic activity with long and variable lags. Of course, these days, financial conditions begin to tighten well in advance of actual rate hikes.
You could say that monetary policy works with long and variable lags has become shorthand for, hey, we're not sure exactly how things are going to play out, but we're doing our best with the data we've got. Historian Jennifer Burns gets the last word on all this.
That being said, I think Friedman would agree that one has to stick with a policy and let it work its way through the system. And so to the extent that the long and variable lag gives the Fed some cover to do that, I think he would appreciate and understand that.
Chair Powell takes the podium tomorrow at 2:30 Eastern. He is always punctual, by the way. We'll see what he says about interest rates and those long and variable lags. Coming up,
This global network is often referred to as the UK's second empire.
Maybe the sun really never does set. But first, let's do the numbers. All righty, here you go. On a Tuesday, Dow Industrial's up 26 points, less than a tenth percent, really flattish. Ended things at 35,438. The NASDAQ up 85 points, about 6-tenths percent, closed at 14,144. The S&P 500 grew about 12 points, 3-tenths percent, finished at 45.67, 4567, if you're paying attention. Tech stocks moved higher today. Apple sweetened 4-tenths percent. Alphabet, parent company of Google, added about a half percent. Microsoft grew 1.7%. Parcel carrier UPS dropped 1.9% today. That is despite news it's reached a tentative deal with the International Brotherhood of Teamsters that should avert a threatened strike. Sabrina was telling us about home prices across the country and how they're moving. Let's take a look at how some home builders fared in the markets today, shall we? KB Home improved 2.1%. Toll Brothers rang up about 2.3%. Pulte shot up 6.2%. Bond prices went the other way. They fell. Yield on the 10-year T-note thus rose 3.89%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did-we-just-hit-a-million-orders stage, Shopify's there to help you grow. Whether you're selling shipping supplies or promoting productivity programs, Shopify helps you sell everywhere. From their all-in-one e-commerce platform to their in-person POS system, wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout, up to 36% better compared to other leading commerce platforms. Plus, Shopify's award-winning help is there to support your success every step of the way. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/marketplace, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/marketplace now to grow your business no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/marketplace.
This Marketplace podcast is supported by Ascensus, helping people dream bigger, aim higher, and save more with financial confidence. Unleash the power of your retirement savings plan with innovative technology that makes things easy, top-notch service from experts who care, and flexible solutions that can grow with you. For more than 40 years, Ascensus has been helping savers achieve their goals. We can help you achieve yours, too. Learn more at Ascensus.com. That's ASCENSUS.com.
Traditional revenue sources for public media and media at large are declining this year, and we at Marketplace are not immune to those trends. We're currently tracking behind target for this budget year. We're tightening up our expenses, yes, but the need for trusted, grounded, fact-based reporting is as pressing as ever, and we simply cannot cut back on our mission. So we're turning to the listeners like you. Please step up now and invest in Marketplace. If you haven't given yet, now's the time. Go to marketplace.org/donate. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We know companies have a pricing dilemma, right? What is the price the market will bear for a product that let the company make money but won't scare away consumers? That's a question very much on the minds of tech companies, big and small, right now as the still nascent AI revolution enters the how do we actually make money from this phase. So far, some consumer-facing AI products are following the tried-and-true freemium model. You can use ChatGPT for free, it goes, that model does. But if you want the best version with the most powerful algorithm, the best AI brain behind it, it's going to be $20 a month. So what exactly are consumers willing to pay? Here's Marketplace's Matt Levin on the evolving AI business model.
The big money in generative AI isn't in you asking ChatGPT to write a sonnet about Hot Pockets and iambic pentameter. The big money is in selling AI to big business, so you can use your work computer to write a sonnet about Hot Pockets. Andrew Merrick covers the tech industry for the investment firm Raymond James, a Marketplace underwriter.
Most of the attention from users has obviously been on the consumer side with ChatGPT and Google Bard. We do think that the enterprise is the greater opportunity overall.
Microsoft will be charging $30 per user per month for businesses to use Copilot, which can whip up PowerPoints and Excel formulas for you. That $30 figure is actually pretty high. The entire Microsoft Office package can be cheaper than that for some businesses.
The promise of AI is a multiples increase in the productivity that a user can gain from these services.
Consumers are more price sensitive, and in that market, AI companies are luring customers with cheap pay-per-use models or discounted monthly subscriptions. Olivia Tubia is at Columbia Business School.
Because you have more and more other services being offered, I think consumers might not just want to have too many subscriptions, just keep it simple.
Tubia says companies that offer a one-stop AI shop, text, audio, photo, video, will have the advantage. I'm Matt Levin for Marketplace.
Like it or not, advertising is a key pillar of global commerce, which is why last week when a couple of the world's biggest ad agency conglomerates reported less than spectacular results, eyebrows were raised. Both Interpublic and Omnicom reported weaker than expected revenue thanks to declining ad spending by mostly technology and telecommunications companies. So analysts are going to be keeping a close eye on Alphabet and Meta, two of the big players in advertising, as you know, when they report results this week to see if or maybe how hard they're going to be hit. Marketplace's Lily Jamali draws out the broader economic issues.
Last year at this time, companies were plowing piles of cash into ads. Keeping up with that kind of spending never seemed realistic, says Brian Weiser at the consultancy Madison & Wall.
We shouldn't be surprised if growth looks slower on a year-over-year basis because there was still a lot of money going into the advertising market a year ago that couldn't last.
Much of that came from tech, including crypto companies and rapid delivery firms, flush with cash they raked in during the pandemic.
The last fumes of spending from advertisers who depended on zero interest rates.
Weiser says Meta, Alphabet, and other tech giants may end up feeling the pinch.
The evaporation of those advertisers will contribute to the soft growth on a relative basis that we're likely to see from Meta, as well as Alphabet, just because that's where the money would have gone.
But the money may still be going to big tech firms. While some companies have pulled back on spending with ad agencies, they may be deploying their marketing dollars in other ways. Paul Hardart is a professor at NYU's Stern School of Business. He says the agency's loss may be the tech company's gain.
There may be more ad spending on their platforms because they can reach a larger audience in a much more targeted way.
Some good news for ad agencies, pharmaceutical firms, car makers, and food and beverage companies have increased their spending. I'm Lily Jamali for Marketplace.
The stipulation, by way of setting up this next story, is that nobody actually likes to pay taxes. Most of us do pay, of course, but big corporations and the wealthy have both the means and the motive to do what they can not to pay. And a report out today by a group called Tax Justice Network over in the UK says global tax receipts over the next decade are going to be $4.7 trillion lower than they should have been thanks to tax dodging, and that the current work to change that just isn't working. From London, Marketplace's Stephen Beard reports.
Tax Justice Network, or TJN, says that over the past decade, countries have lost around $470 billion annually to tax havens and are likely to lose a similar amount over the next 10 years. The biggest casualty in numerical terms, says TJN's Mark Boumansour, is the biggest economy.
The U.S. loses about $176 billion a year to tax havens.
And he says the biggest recipient of the global outflows is the UK, along with a string of small former colonies, some in the Caribbean.
This is why this global network is often referred to as the UK's second empire, with all these former colonies now funneling money into the city of London.
That second empire, he says, sucks up a third of global tax dodging cash, But let's not bash exclusively the Brits or cast the US as the worst affected. Low-income countries suffer much more from those lost revenues. And, says Ian Gary of the Financial Accountability and Corporate Transparency Coalition in Washington, the US isn't blameless.
When people think about tax havens, they think about palm-fringed Caribbean islands, but some of the most important tax havens now are snow-covered places like South Dakota in the wintertime.
Leading the global fight against tax avoidance and evasion has been the OECD club of 38 mostly high-income economies. Corporate lobbying has diluted its reforms, claims Mark Boumanser of Tax Justice Network.
From any angle you look at it, the process has completely failed.
The OECD disagrees. The group's head of tax policy, Manal Cohen, says Tax Justice Network exaggerates the level of evasion.
Their methodology is flawed, and then their projections don't take into account significant developments.
Like the agreed plan for a global minimum corporate tax rate and the automatic information-sharing agreements between tax authorities in different countries. TJN, she says, isn't giving the OECD any credit.
They completely ignore some of the most important reforms seen in international taxation for decades now.
But other tax justice campaigners say that global tax reform has stalled and must be taken up by the United Nations, which represents all countries, rich and poor. Ugandan lawyer and activist Irene Ovingi-Odita says the OECD isn't as inclusive as the UN.
Look at the UN as the place where all countries are at the table on an equal basis, where the rules are clear, and they can then negotiate.
The OECD says it would not be ticked off if the UN did become involved in the fight against tax avoidance. Indeed, two international bodies competing to shut down the tax havens could prove more effective. In London, I'm Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
Final note on the way out today. It's another one for the, maybe there is going to be a soft landing. File from the conference board today, another reading on consumer confidence. It's high. We are the most confident we've been in 2 years. That's across all income levels and age groups. Expectations for the next 6 months, the group said, have improved materially. All right, here's your moment of economic context on the way out. Kind of a follow-on to that consumer confidence thing. Also, a nod to the high-frequency data thing I mentioned in the long and variable lag piece. New data out from Visa today in its earnings call. Payment volume, the company says, which is a fancy way to say how much we're using our cards, was up 9% in the quarter ended in June. Our digital and on-demand team includes Carrie Barber, Dylan Miettinen, Janet Wynn, Olga Oxman, Ellen Rolfes, Virginia K. Smith, and Tony Wagner. Francesca Levy is the executive director of digital and on-demand. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
My name is Lee Hawkins. I've been a journalist for over 25 years. On my new podcast, What Happened in Alabama, I get answers to some of the hardest questions about how things came to be for many Black Americans and the truth that must come before any reconciliation can happen. I investigate my family history, my upbringing in Minnesota, and my father's painful nightmares about growing up in Alabama.
What Happened in Alabama is a new series confronting the cycles of trauma for myself, my family, and for many Black Americans. Listen now.